Okay, boss.
That was a
Can
very
I get an
immediate
Italian
decision.
sub? Can I? Oh wait, sorry, wrong chat.
Wrong chat.
I was on a Zoom with the sandwich company.
I don't like how we can just be live with a 3 second notice. Very intimidating.
So so happy you're not at RSA or got the FOMO going.
I've never been, and I feel like at this point it's like it's not gonna happen. I'm not allowed to go now.
You know, it's nice to see all my friends who are there, but the smell of desperation coming off of the show floor is sometimes a little noxious. So you've got every freaking security vendor in the world trying to stand out with their essentially homogenous product from every other security vendor in the planet. It's just ridiculous hype going on.
I think John and Jason are there. I'm assuming they're just going around like spraying like anti-hype water on people, being like, the power of AI compels you. The power of AI compels you.
I think I'm still getting email from when I last went to RSA about 7 years ago. For that reason, I never want to go again.
Yeah, I've never been to RSA and I get a ton of email about it constantly. Oh, come to our event, come to our parties, come to this. While you're out there, why don't you meet up with us about this? Why?
I know I'm dating myself here, but 1 year as a prank, we went to RSA with a box of one of our colleagues' business cards, and we dropped their business card into every single fishbowl on the show floor. We did like a divide and conquer thing. Yeah, it was hilarious. They were getting their mailbox was full like every day with junk mail from different tech companies. It was awesome.
I like whenever I go to a conference like that, I'm like actually interested in the product, and they're like, oh, like, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I don't really want to like tell them where I work. I'll be
like,
you're
a
goat
farmer.
Right. And immediately they're like, oh, you're a student. Never mind. Next person.
Yeah. Don't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
It's like the, what is it? The show Undercover Boss. You're just like going around being like, oh, I'm a student. I'm a student. Yeah. And you're actually like an angel fund with $100 million looking for which organization to invest. That'd be a fun little show. Silicon Valley 2 writers, hit me up. I'm here.
So the last round telling people you're a student and then showing up at the keynote being the speaker, that would be a power move.
Nice.
That would be good too. But the only people who speak at RSA are people with like 100K plus Twitter followers. So it'd be like a hard challenge.
The last RSA I went to, I was young and naive, and I actually fell for the free airport shuttle ride to the venue.
Did you get a timeshare pitch for like 16 hours? What happened?
You get in the shuttle, and I won't say what vendor it was, but they just sit there and they trap you, and then they give you t-shirts and water bottles and show you a marketing video while they take you the longest way they can.
You're like on Google Maps, you're like, are we there yet? You're like over in
no, they're like
Marin
going up
County.
The east side of the bay, you know, Fremont, Oakland, like coming over the Bay Bridge. Yeah.
I was going to say that could be us right up until the video part.
Yeah, that's what we should do at a Wild West Hack and Fest. Like the most direct route from airport to conference is a whole hour.
I think that's the only route, is it not?
It's pretty much.
It's the only road.
Depends on how creative you get.
I feel like
and what kind of four-wheel drive you have, you know.
Yeah, I feel like it should be like a stagecoach. It's like, here's like a bus and there's like a horse-drawn carriage, and it's like, choose your adventure. Which shuttle would you rather take?
Only if I get to ride shotgun, you know, like real shotgun.
I mean, it is South Dakota. I'm sure that could be arranged.
Yeah. My first time going to Deadwood, I got a rental car, and at home, like, I have a just like a Prius, right? It doesn't go very fast. And the first time I landed, they're like, oh yeah, like we've selected you to be upgraded to like, you know, the like presidential rental car. And I was like, okay, whatever.
That's
like
the only car we have left. Here you go.
Right. And I like go out into the parking lot and I like press the key, and it's like some crazy like Dodge Challenger. I'm like, this is not safe for me. Like, this is not good.
Good luck.
Then you heard him screaming enjoy all the way to Deadwood. Woo!
Literally on my way, I passed more like deer on the road than other cars, which was a little weird because I got in so late. It was a little frightening.
Yeah, there's definitely more livestock in South Dakota than there are human beings.
Would not surprise me.
Isn't that how it should be? Like, that's the way that we have the closing dinner.
It's true.
Yeah.
There's more livestock before the conference, but
I mean, I don't think you need one cow per person to feed one person.
speak for yourself.
True.
Yeah, I can only eat like a quarter of the cow on my own.
Yeah, 1-4 is like a safe ratio, I think.
Just like inodes.
Mm-hmm. No, you can just increase those. Don't worry. Just set it to infinite. It's fine.
Either that or the rest of the cow can like go home with you as part of the conference swag bag. Okay.
I feel like TSA would have something to say about that.
No, really.
Like, why
it's not
do you
a human
have
body.
A carry-on full of 160 pounds of beef? And you're like, South Dakota? They're like, well, you got us there.
Bring some dehydrated conference.
I will say, coming back from South Dakota, I had, I think, two or three laptops coming back. And the guy at security was like, not prepared for that. He was like, why would you ever need more than one laptop? And I was like,
they're so nice at Rapid City. Yeah. They're just like, hey, how are you doing? How's your life? Tell me. Let's spend 15 minutes talking.
Yep.
That's small always what I look for in an airport, is the longest interaction with a TSA employee as possible. Mm-hmm. That's small my success metric.
My favorite was, he was like very actually interested in why I would need more than one laptop. And I was like, look, you're going to have like a lot of people coming through here in the next like couple hours that are flying out. And you're going to see a lot of laptops.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you could extend that conversation by saying, well, actually, I'm a hacker.
No.
That gets you escorted into like a private room.
All of my wireless gear one time going through TSA for a test, and TSA stopped me. I was like, they think all of my antennas are something bad. They looked through all of them. They found my lockpicks. They were like, oh, these are cool. This is a good brand. And then they stole my toothpaste.
Yeah.
Nice.
That sounds about right.
Should we get rolling?
Let's get rolling.
Where are we going?
I mean, who's even in charge of this? Is it?
Give me the fingers and the hype music. Come on.
Oh, it's going to be me. Or sorry, it's going to be May.
Yeah.
Are we democratizing the leader role?
It's an entirely anarchist.
No democracy. This is a dictatorship. John Strand is the dictator, and I'm his like small squire in charge this week. We're gonna be tilting his windmills.
If we start, then you won't be able to hear my story about the time I had exposed wires from a HID reader and got to get searched by the TSA. Like, full-on pat-down, and my wife was videoing it, so...
How long is this story?
No, that's the story. So
that's it? Oh, no. Well, then we just heard it.
Yeah.
We could have saved it right for the end, just like goat diarrhea, and...
that was after...
Oh, you nearly got pen on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get there. All right, roll the finger.
All right, let's do this. 3, 2. Oh, wait, it already counts down. I don't need to do that.
Hello and welcome to Black Hills Information Security's Talking About News. It's May 6th, 2024. If you're not at RSA, you're here. That's how it works. And so is everyone else that's here, which includes Al, Jackie, Interdimensional Graham Hacker, known as S'mores. Two S'mores, two quit? I don't know. I'm confused. Pen Tester, Andrew Krug, and Derek, who's a BHIS OG. Sitting in the dark. I feel like he's got some stories for us ready to report.
What are you talking about? This is as light as my cave gets.
Nice. He's going to slap the base.
Email address.
If we get him really riled up, he'll slap the base. That's how it works. And then we got Ryan, who's definitely well lit in contrast to Derek. Cough, cough, Derek.
Fine.
He hasn't learned anything from me.
I will be all professional and I will fix my lighting. How about that?
This week, we're going to discuss Sandbox Escape, GitLab, Reval Hackers, Microsoft Outlook flaws. Ooh, that sounds a little bit familiar. I guess any news from RSA? Do people use social media, right? Does anyone like follow along with what's going on? I know John and Jason are there doing backdoors and breaches. So I guess if you are there and somehow you're watching this, then go find them and get like some free merch or something.
Or if you're on the way.
So I think the biggest thing that we all make fun of every year and spend time thinking about is the BDBIR release for the year.
Yeah. That was so three podcasts ago, or many podcasts ago. But
everyone is reacting to it.
There's a reaction video / not video, but article about it that we wanted to discuss. Good old Kelly Shortridge. I don't know who that is.
Nobody knows who that is.
Do you know who that is? Are you going to out someone that like isn't publicly known?
No, I think Kelly Shortridge is a prominent personality in the InfoSec space, like primarily at the intersection of sociology and the cyber, and writes these hilarious articles, sort of holding a mirror up to our industry. And if you can't tell that from the H1s in this article, I don't know what you're looking at.
See, I was assuming that Kelly Shortridge was a cat sitting on top of a AI-generated server rack with a pile of money.
That's all we need to know, isn't it?
This actually is a very well-written article, and I'm a fan. So
yeah, what are the takeaways? Is it basically just, I mean, I'm looking through the headings, and they are fun. Attackers are not using Gen AI. Don't tell anyone at RSA that. Those are like some fighting words at RSA.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know,
headlines
like,
are great.
That everybody, you know, wants to believe that they're, you know, the target of some, you know, Uber nation state Uber hack source, but the reality is that, you know, what most people are going to experience is just, you know, run of the mill, you know, financial crime, ransomware kind of crap. So
business email compromise, it's like the largest financial impact, right? Something like that.
See,
but it's so boring. It's not cool. You can't buy a product to prevent people from doing stupid things. Yes. I don't like that.
I'm not always convinced that nation states aren't after money too. I mean,
well, yeah, sure.
We're working one of those. I assume y'all talked about the Palo Alto stuff at least a couple of podcasts ago, and we're working an incident right now. And like the threat actors that got on that Palo Alto tried to upload a coin miner. So I don't know.
The intern was like, "I will contribute. Here I go." And they were like, "Sorry, intern. No, it's a firewall."
I mean, this one that you're scrolling by is kind of interesting. Security teams that have ransomware budgets, so confidence for, you know, whether or not you'll be able to act on it versus pay it.
Right.
Definitely don't tell your CISO that 96% of incidents had no loss. Yeah. Well, you gotta like forecast it. I'd say our range could be anywhere from $3 to $1.1 million. So, I mean, budget for that, I guess.
Yeah.
Hey, I've actually sat in a boardroom where the CISO's boss, you know, the CEO, said that they were prepared to pay up to something stupid. I think it was like $250 million in a ransom. And my jaw hit the floor. It's like, wait, what? That's, wow. Okay.
That just means their buddy is the CEO of an insurance company.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love these kinds of reactions on, you know, things to kind of, I mean, I don't know, it's tough because on one hand, I like to go to my customers and say, hey, this stuff is happening, yo. But then on the other hand, you know, there's always a reality check of most of this stuff is stuff that mature organizations should be aware of and should be able to defend against. And also that sadly, no product will defend against, you know, business email compromise. There's not like a golden ticket for that. So
yeah, I would say that
there's a vast chasm between should be and do, you know. So I've gotten a lot of mileage in my consulting practice about, you know, going into companies and saying, look, there's all these people who are in your ear about the latest and greatest zero days and stuff like that, but like you all could, you know, spend a fraction of that money that they want you to spend on that product and have much better success in your infrastructure just by doing basic block and tackle stuff that you already should be doing but aren't, you know,
implementing MFA.
Yeah,
no, that's too hard. You could buy a fancy Gen AI based user analytics tool, or you could just go in your SharePoint, create a document called cyberinsurancelimits.docx, and then anytime someone opens that file, you just lock out the entire domain.
I would say that most of the incidents,
not exactly the canary strategy I would recommend, but
yeah, there's probably better.
That's
way
called the that's called the canary nuke in the gold mine. Basically, the canary just explodes and blows up the whole mine.
So. Yeah, I would say that the majority of at least 75% of the incidents that we worked at Black Hills last year were business email compromise. And almost all the time, I, you know, when I asked if you had MFA enabled, they were like, yeah, we're getting to that. Yeah. But you get to it now.
You know who doesn't have MFA enabled? Dropbox. Nice segue. Yeah.
But then, you know, on top of that, we definitely had some customers too who had MFA enabled, and then, you know, they were getting, you know, transparent proxy fished. And so that's not a silver bullet, but it certainly helps.
Was it a customer on an incident, and they had, you know, MFA on their 2-year plan, and then after they got breached, it became a 2-day rollout. You know, it was like, okay, I guess we're doing this right now. You know,
funny how that works.
Yeah,
that is how it works. You gotta wait for the breach, or, you know, fun pen test, and then roll out MFA. And yeah, I guess if the insurance company is paying the bills, it's a different story. But
yeah
anyway, where I was going before Derek just like took my segue and threw a like little stick through the spokes, which I don't even think segways have spokes, but like, I don't know, maybe he like put a 2x4 on the ground. I'm assuming a segway can't really like conquer a 2x4 based on the fact that the CEO fell off his roof and died. Anyway, on a segue, possibly, we don't know. Deep cut. But basically, Dropbox Sign, which appears to be a recent acquisition of Dropbox, or somewhat recent, it was called HelloSign. Looks like the attacker compromised a service account. I think the details are a little bit... does anyone know of any additional details on like how the account was compromised? I'm guessing either password guessing, no MFA, or maybe it was reset. I don't know, but basically there was a service account, high privilege, that they compromised. It had access to the back end. It was a non-human account, and so it had high privileges, and basically the attacker could dump the entire database. I feel like Dropbox, other than being thin on the details of how the account was compromised, did a pretty good job of providing, you know, next steps and resetting all the accounts, all the OAuth. It's pretty pretty extensive, the lengths they've gone to. They've rolled everyone's passwords, rolled everyone's MFA, rolled everyone's API keys. So I guess that's pretty pretty effective, theoretically, but I'm sure there'll be follow-up attacks based on, you know, who was a customer and stuff like that. But kind of a scary breach. I don't really know what this is. This like their version of DocuSign, I assume? Is that what it is?
I think so, yeah.
And at this point, just, Dropbox has been breached so many times, they probably have like a runbook and playbook that's just for this all by itself.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess
crisis
like,
communications on speed dial, you know.
I wonder what the customer base is even like of Dropbox Sign. But the data should be pretty high value. So Dropbox Sign was used, like it's advertised as NDAs, tax forms, and even more with legally binding e-signatures. So I guess you gained access to it. People that are using it probably have lots of crown jewels in there, or at the very least, lots of social security numbers, bank account numbers. We just talked about financially motivated threat actors. We don't know exactly what their goal was with this, but it seems like if you got into Dropbox Sign and you started messing around with people's documents, you could potentially get some money.
Did they get access to the content or just like the user information?
It seems like just the user information. Dropbox claims that they prevented access to people's actual data. They said they found no evidence of unauthorized access to the contents of users' accounts, such as their documents or agreements. That's good. I'm assuming they caught it quickly enough to prevent that, because if you had the whole customer database, I mean, it looks like they were going after people's MFA keys or tokens and API keys and passwords. So I guess they cut it off and reset everything before the threat actors were able to actually use the compromised database, possibly, or we don't know. They haven't really said why.
Well, you know how breach reporting goes. It always gets worse, you know, the longer things go on. So maybe the next report is going to be like, oh, did we say they didn't get access to the content? Sorry, we were wrong about that. They got everybody's content.
Yes, that is exactly right.
I mean, this is a fun bullet in here. If you reuse your Dropbox Sign password on any other service, we strongly recommend that you change your password on those accounts, which indicates to me there's probably also a database password hashes that
totally
that was not properly, you know, somebody's not handling a password the right way.
Well, right. Yeah. I mean, if it's bcrypt, it might take them a while, but they'll get to it eventually. It's funny because the Dropbox breach from 2012 was a mix of bcrypt and SHA-1. So I guess like I know that I'm in some communities where they're still trying to recover the passwords from Dropbox from 2012. So it might be a long time, but definitely reset your passwords on Dropbox. I feel like they've kind of fallen out of favor. I feel like at one point they were kind of the standard, but I haven't heard anyone say Dropbox in a while. I'm sure they're still pretty popular in the small and medium business world, but
yeah, for corporate, I think it would be rare, you know, because I feel like a lot of that has bled off to other platforms.
Totally.
From a Microsoft, business perspective. Yeah.
Microsoft. Here's your terabyte, right?
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Can we talk about this Judge Zero exploit for a little bit?
Well, we know on the show, this is a fun one because we know from this show that developers never do anything that's insecure. So this is actually the first historically documented instance of that ever occurring. What is Judge Zero?
So Judge Zero is this platform for creating evaluation flow. You take a test and it allows you to, you know, create within the Judge Zero framework a test that users can take, you know, that where they submit code and things like that and gets evaluated. But I tell you, I'm like reading these exploits and it's like, Jesus, the 90s called and they want their vulnerabilities back. You know, it's like it's like insecure symlinks in /temp and chmodding files in /temp and things like that. I mean, this is,
and using Ruby.
Are we not educating developers on historical security problems? I mean, like, thousands of people have been dragged through this minefield over and over again and like perpetrated these vulnerabilities. And then like every new generation of programmers, it seems like,
I'd say, no, we are not.
Walks into that minefield completely blindly again. And, you know, it's like, you know, and
well,
here we
see
are.
How this was the ultimate test of people's abilities is if you go beyond the test and actually hack the company brokering it, that's how you get an A.
That's the maximum score. Yeah, it's just like such a class of vulnerabilities that we've known really for decades. And to see it popping up again is a little disheartening, frankly.
I wonder how much of this started out just from looking at their like GitHub and kind of like their older stuff. It looks like this started out as just like a little side project that was then turned into a platform. And so I wonder if like it just started with like, oh, I'm going to, you know, work on this little project for school. And then it turned into, wait, we could actually sell this. And then they just kind of built on top of it.
It sounds like every development project ever. We'll prototype it. Now it's in production.
Do they actually, I guess, they have pricing listed, but it's not very expensive. I guess this might give away their security status because the most expensive plan is $54 a month for consumers. Or 54 euros, so even more. But yeah, they say contact us, you know, for the dedicated cloud, which I'm assuming was being used by some of the top providers that used it, like Algo Daily, CodeJum, and Pi Native. Yeah, I think it's, I guess it's one of those things where if along the way, if you make the decision that you don't really care about the data in the platform, it'll never get security added to it. And I guess for whatever reason, they were like, it's just like developers learning how to code. Who cares? There's no crown jewels in there.
Whatever.
The subheading of the article says multiple critical security flaws have been disclosed to the Judge Zero open source online code execution system that could be exploited to obtain code execution on the target system.
I know. When I read the article for the first time, I thought it was like a malware program. Like I was like, okay, so someone's rootkit got rootkitted. Like that's how I was reading it. But then I was like, this is actually like a developer thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Judge Zero does kind of sound like a piece of malware.
Yeah. Right? So, I'm assuming we're going to, you know, people are going to be looking at the software more closely now. We're going to find many more vulnerabilities. I mean, if this was the initial entry in the series of Judge Zero exploits, I would say expect many more. We'll see.
Yes. I guess out of curiosity, like what are other, because I feel like sandboxing is a pretty common like use case in a lot of places like Code Academy, you know, Hack the Box. I mean, there's obviously security sandboxing, like what is it, Joe Sandbox or whatever. There's a bunch of them. So I guess like what are the other options? If you're, I mean, maybe this is an Andrew question, I don't know, but like if you want to have people running code on your server, but do it securely. What else is out there?
I mean, don't is the best answer. So years back, we sorted this roundup of the different. So authentication providers are a really interesting one where they do use a lot of the sandboxing to process OAuth claims and stuff in flow. And like if you follow it all the way down to the base syscall, there's basically like the same syscall at the bottom of all this, you know, that goes back to like BSD jails and like Linux containers and all that. And there's no great perfect way to do this, right? So if you actually really care about this stuff and your threat model is that somebody can escape a sandbox and then escalate privilege, you need dedicated tenancy. And we've done some cool stuff as an industry with like micro VMs, like Firecracker and all that, but it's all really the same fundamental tenants. GVisor gets a little bit better in terms of isolation, but not loads better.
I guess when you're trying to run a test for developers, you kind of have to run their code though. So I guess I get why it would have happened this way.
Do y'all consider a container a security boundary at this point? I know some people go back and forth.
It depends on the container.
Do you consider the container is just a process, right? With restricted, I don't know. I would say like the biggest thing.
Container is a separate kernel namespace, right?
Yeah. I guess I would say yes, but with some caveats.
If I had to say, I would say yes.
You can enforce a bit of a security boundary on the container using something like SE Linux. You can put it in its own SE Linux security, not level, but context. I mean, it's multi-level security, but instead of using security level, you use the security tags. So like, documents can be both like top secret and proprietary, right? So with SE Linux, you can give a security context to each individual container that keeps it separate from all the other containers you have running around in that kernel. I mean, that can help a little bit. I don't know. I think there's a ton of container attack surface that we just haven't uncovered yet. But if you want to believe that it's a security boundary, okay, more power to you.
Yeah, what do we think the percentage is of folks that are admitting Kubernetes clusters that are running SE Linux 100% of the time or AppArmor 100% of the time and have adopted that as a practice?
That'd be zero.
I was going to say 0.1%.
Yeah.
Just because you can doesn't mean that people do.
Sure.
Yeah, I think a lot of the reason we don't see more container escapes and things is because they're just such high complexity to actually do anything with them that like it's like, all right, I've escaped the container and I'm on a server with 50,000 Docker containers. What do I do now?
Sell that access?
You are eaten by a GRU.
Yeah. Right.
So we actually see tons of basic container escapes. So I mean, they just don't make headlines, right? Because they're such basic things. Like a file is shared, you know, that has access to like set UID or something really fundamentally basic, or the container has the wrong cap permissions and it's got a raw socket exposed internally, or it was run with privileged, as part of a daemon set. So there's just lots and lots that we don't talk about that I think are seen relatively frequently.
Yeah, that must be hard to kind of report and evaluate. It's like, all right, the AWS server you were on was shared by 80,000 people over a 6-month instance. So I guess notify all of them. I don't know. It's like, that's got to be a fun incident to run down.
Also, why bother escaping from the container when the apps running inside of the container are so vulnerable that you can pop containers at will.
The container that you got off Docker Hub contains malware.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Oh, hey, that's a good segue.
I know, right?
I feel like I should somehow like sabotage it. I feel like I should sabotage it. Yeah. Derek, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? All right.
If this is the article, I think it is. I saw a bunch of people, I think they just read the headline of the article and they assume that a bunch of Docker images were compromised or they had malware in them, which is true. Like there are plenty of Docker images with malware, but let me find the actual article people were sharing last week. Is it in here?
Yeah, it's in here somewhere.
If you're the person who says I need a Docker container to deploy this because I don't know any other way of deploying it, and then you just search around for random versions of a Docker container that have similar things that you're trying to run, then this blog post is for you.
Is this the article?
It's under malware finds a way. That's the
one. It's millions of Docker repos found pushing malware, comma, phishing sites.
So
that's the one.
I saw this last week, and a bunch of people were saying, like, oh, you know, this means that the Docker images themselves are containing malware. But that's not entirely true. It's basically like the README of the Docker image page has links that contains malware. It's not like the actual images themselves were infected, because all the ones that they were looking for don't actually have any images attached to them. It'd be like if you were to publish like a GitHub repository and you only had the README in there, and the README was like, oh, for information on how to install this, go to this page. And then that page was a phishing page or something like that.
Yeah.
That's like a neat twist on the link in the YouTube bio, right? Click here to get your
screen. That's exactly what it is. It's a link in the bio that takes you to a site where it's like, so you were trying to run Nginx in a Docker container, and now you're downloading a cracked copy of ExpressVPN. I don't know how you got here, but here you are.
It's a prerequisite.
I'm assuming, so the research was published by JFrog, which is surprisingly a company, not a hacker name, sadly. But basically like Graham said, they analyzed some GitHub or some, I'm assuming Docker Hub. So they analyzed some Docker Hub repositories. I guess, like, out of curiosity, why didn't they go deeper? I'm assuming just compute complexity to actually like pull this many images. Like, you could at least look at the Docker files and be like, the Docker file is just like curl bitcoinminer.sh.
Well, the way that they scanned the like Docker Hub, I guess, repository is they look for Docker Hub, I guess repos would be the right term for them, repos that didn't actually contain a Docker image.
So they're looking for like explicitly useless repos.
Right. Or, like, it would almost be like scanning GitHub for pages that are repos that only had a README without any actual code.
It's like README CVE exploit, and it's just like a link to, you know, reactor resume.docx. Yeah.
Right.
All right. So Andrew, Datadog's going to do a wholesale analysis of all Docker containers on Docker Hub and find malware, right?
This is a huge opportunity, right? And it's not just for Docker Hub, because since Docker Hub put in place the public restrictions, I feel like a lot of people have actually bled really important images off of Docker Hub into things like public ECR repositories and GCR. And those are ripe for research right now. Like, we're going to see tons of stuff come out over the next like year or two, where people are either doing credential scanning on those that are marked public accidentally, intentionally, whatever. But there's going to be a lot of that kind of stuff going on in those places that are not the places that we're used to looking.
Would you say that people are using GitLab to host their own Docker registries?
No, we're actually a segue.
Allow me to hop on my Segway, which now has off-road tires and can drive off cliffs.
See, I didn't ruin it that time.
Well, you're
not yet anyway.
You have a chance.
It's still time.
So yeah, basically this next article, 1,400 GitLab servers are impacted by a vulnerability. I guess, does anyone want to run through the vulnerability? Does anyone know it off the top of their head? Because it's, I guess the way that I read it, or I'll open it up. Does anyone actually know it?
It's not a default credential, is it? Because I've definitely worked at GitLab with a bad incident.
I think it's a little stupider and also cooler at the same time.
Okay, good.
So I looked at it a few weeks ago. If anyone else knows way more, like, feel free to go ahead, but I got the gist of it.
Yeah, go ahead.
So basically, GitLab a few months ago, maybe like 5 or 6 months ago, had a vulnerability in their password reset feature where you could email a password reset for someone's account to your own email, which is essentially like, you know, account takeover. And like very, very quickly, there was a bunch of like proof of concepts because it was like fairly simple to do. You would basically just supply the email of the user that you want to reset, and then your email afterwards with like some, you know, different characters to kind of like trick the system. And then their password reset would go to your email, and then you could reset the password and log in.
That's fun.
I wonder if you could also do like their email semicolon rm minus rf slash star. I mean, that's what the vulnerability sounds like to me.
That would secure the server, though. That would fix the security
issue. It's true. Yeah, probably
that
not.
Patches it
because the web app doesn't have proofs. But
So this is a fun vulnerability, but I think I'm reading between the lines a little bit on it and seeing like the, so at the end of January, the some statistics company that I've never heard of called the Shadow Server Foundation, which I probably should have heard of them because it sounds really cool. They reported in the end of January, there were 5,300 that had not been patched. Then it was added to the CISA KEV on, let's see, Wednesday. So that was in April, whatever, late April. And then they checked again, and as of May 1st, there were only 1,400. So I guess, like, my question is, does adding something to the known exploited vulnerabilities catalog, does that, like, lead to a big patch cycle, or are people just running, like, a couple months behind? Or a couple, I guess, more like a year behind? I'm kind of curious what people's take is on that.
Has anybody here ever actually gone through the exercise of patching community GitLab?
Yeah, there was a...
I did it on my home lab.
Because it's painful sometimes, right?
It seemed like there was somebody who posted I don't know, something to consider if you're hosting it. GitLab comes out with new versions pretty often. If you don't keep up with point releases, good luck. So if you're not keeping up, you're probably really out of date. So thanks for that information.
Good to know.
Yeah. That was painful.
I mean, Go ahead. GitLab a bit. So go ahead.
I'll just say when this came out, GitLab had patched it. And if you were using their kind of like managed GitLab service, then like obviously you got the update. But if you're self-hosting it, you have to go and actually pull that update. And depending on how you're hosting it, it's varying levels of difficulty. For me, I was just doing it in a offline like home lab, right? So I wasn't exposed to the internet or anything. And it was just as simple as pulling the new like Docker container. And it took 5 minutes. But it would probably be way more difficult if I was hosting something that multiple other people were using, or I had some, you know, crazy setup.
Andrew, rip on GitLab some. I'm here for it.
Just historically, you know, I had also a personal home lab, GitLab for years that didn't run in containers, but it was, you know, one of those things that I had to care and feed over time. And I can't tell you how many times during the patch cycle that thing just literally exploded during a patch and had to like roll back the database. And then there's, you know, encryption keys for like there's all these opportunities to just epically fail. Hopefully it's gotten better. Also, this is one of those things I feel like if we're talking about 1990s, a lot of the components used to be written in Ruby, or at least JRuby. I'm not sure if they're still.
Yeah, but
there's some legacy here.
I have some mixed feelings because on one hand, I'm like, well, their whole shtick is like, if you don't want to deal with this, just pay us for the hosted solution, which seems fair to me. But on the other hand, it is kind of like, I guess I don't know their history with like taking community pull requests and things like that, but it is kind of the standard, I would say, for like self-hosted Git repos, right? I mean, there's not really any alternatives out there that I know of that get a lot of use. So
if you want workflow, it's the standard. Like if you want anything beyond just like basic Git functionality with effectively what you have in GitHub, like PRs and issue tracking.
I mean, it has its own Docker registry now. It has runners and all that stuff. It's actually pretty, we use it heavily internally. I actually had to reset my account because I forgot my password. So I just typed in John Strand's email and then put my email. But yeah, I think it's pretty powerful as a tool. So it's sad that, I will say I've heard, you know, similar things on from our sysadmins of being like, guys, we're patching. So GitLab's going to be down for between 5 and 24 hours. Good luck.
Get your code.
I think what's
now.
Really the really sad thing is that this is effectively an authentication bypass that's like a very actually common mistake that people make in complex code bases. And I think that's the thing to really fixate on here, which is that a lot of these password reset email processes don't get the right level of integration testing. When somebody makes a modification, it's very easy to screw up and have an if else then end up failing open.
I mean, this sounds more like an input sanitization issue more than anything. It's like, oh, I can supply two emails and you'll email them both, you know?
Yeah. It's probably passing it straight to PostFix, I guess.
Well, I was kind of fixating on the unverified part of that, because in theory and the logic for that flow, there should first be something that says that this is actually a valid verified email that's associated with this. And if that flag up somewhere in the chain of decision making was, you know, let's say it's in like a try catch block or something along those lines, and it falls through to an exception that's like not well handled. Mm-hmm. That could be the first misstep. Totally.
I mean, it makes sense. Like, arguably, from the developer's perspective, their job was to get people access to their accounts, not have it fail closed, right? But yes, like, if there's, I mean, this is why business logic flaws are often the most interesting ones, right? Because, like, well, you know, we tried this, and then people weren't able to access their accounts, so we, you know, put some comments in front of that little check, and 5 years later, here we are. Right.
I don't know if anybody here is actually a Rubyist, and not to like bash on the language at all, but it has dot try for a function. if you're built on Rails, which is basically an exception handler that just says bury the exception, and if it throws one, go on. So you'll see that all the time in Ruby code bases, particularly in Rails environments where they just go, well, like screw it, dot try, and now it works. Passes every test.
Chmod 777.
Yeah. Now, I identified on the show already that developers are the most secure developers. Like, if you're building a product for developers, it has to be, you know, as secure as possible. You definitely wouldn't skip a bunch of steps because you don't feel like spending a bunch of time writing the system to write your system.
To be fair to developers, it's not developers being lazy. It's the difference in mindset of thinking, what should this thing I'm building do? Versus what can this thing that I built do, which is the question that hackers are asking. So unless you like switch mindsets, it's really easy to overlook things like that.
That's why we have smart people.
Stop
like
trying to humanize them.
Stop defending developers.
Employed, man. What can I say?
Which is also present in the testing of authentication flows. Like, a lot of times when folks write flows like this, they test the happy path and they do not test the unhappy paths.
Mm-hmm. Just like companies rolling out MFA and forgetting their service accounts. Drop them.
Did we not just talk about the Duo SMS to FA bypass like last week or the week before? Nothing is sacred.
No.
I mean, it's why we can't have nice things on the internet, right?
Yeah. All right. So let's talk. I think if everyone's cool, that I'd like to close out the show, or possibly close out the show, with people's hot takes on the whole LastPass situation. Because I think it's something we had talked about a lot on the show, about the LastPass breach and how they were using bad crypto and, you know, maybe the actual article itself is that LastPass has gone independent. I don't exactly know what that means, but they're basically, I think they were owned by what, LogMeIn, I think, or GoTo, which is the company that owns LogMeIn, or like,
Wait, is it that GoTo spun them off? Because that would be like, oh wait, y'all have had too many breaches and GoTo spins you off. That's some serious stuff right there, right?
Well,
yeah, pretty much.
That was it. Yeah, that's basically it. And I guess I don't know if they're...
That's like getting thrown off the island of Misfit Toys, you know?
That's kind of what I was thinking.
I guess, I mean, we're totally speculating. I want to lay that out. None of us have worked for any of these companies that I know of, at least. And so we're speculating. But I guess I'm kind of like, is this some weird, like, abusive relationship where they're going back and forth being like, well, you're less secure than us. No, we're not. We're more secure than you. And they're just going back and forth with their parent company being like, no, you're going to get hacked. No, you're going to get hacked. All right. Whoever gets hacked gets spun off first. I don't know. But I guess, do they have a chance? Can they win people back over? Do people that buy LastPass even know about breaches? I don't know.
I see. So I think, like most people, like outside of this little echo chamber we're in, like have no visibility about this. Like if you're an average person, where like your techie, you know, nephew has set up LastPass for you, so you don't have to remember all those stupid passwords, you're going to keep using LastPass, you know.
But is it better for you to keep doing that or to go back to using the same crappy password for everything, right?
No. I mean,
let's assume you had a long enough master password. Let's say it was 20 characters or something. Are you still
the worst
okay?
Worst thing people use is not the one crappy password. It's saving all their passwords in their browser. And if you don't believe why that's a bad thing, go look at my blog about Stealer malware.
I'm telling you for a fact, I know people personally who still use the same crappy password for everything. And I tell them over and over again, you shouldn't do that. But I mean, using an insecure password manager or using a crappy password, what's better? Or using the browser. Like, they're all crappy solutions, right?
This is the question I get asked the most at, like, parties or, like, you know, dinner parties or whatever. People are like, hey, like, myself. Okay, this happens to me on a semi-regular basis, okay? People come up to me, and these are typically, you know, family members, extended family, and they say, I'm doing X for security, and they want, like, my take on it. And, like, I've never been like, yeah, that's really good. Like, I've literally never said that. Like, I think the most common thing is, I have a spreadsheet, okay? And this, like, they like want the theoretical attack surface on this. I'm like, the biggest thing with the spreadsheet is you're just going to lose it. It's insecure.
My advice typically is, especially for older folks, because, you know, I am a little older and I have friends who are a little older than me and family members, is I tell them to write it down in a notebook and keep it in their drawer. And why do I say that? Because they're not going to use some technical solution. They're still in this, you know, analog mindset. And I figure, you know, if somebody breaks in their house and gets the password, you know, the password notebook, well, that's kind of outside of the threat model. Somebody breaking into their house, right? Isn't that more serious than the passwords? So I don't know.
See, I do that because they can't read my handwriting. So it's kind of like,
well, that works too. Yeah.
Security.
Do you know what a Rolodex is? This is like the question. Just ask the person. If someone comes up to you and says, what do I do for password security? Ask them, do you know what a Rolodex is? And if they say yes, they just be like, do you have one still? And yes. You know, there you go. You're done.
Just use that.
Otherwise, I mean, I still recommend LastPass. I typically recommend 1Password more, but technically I think LastPass is one of the only free ones left, if I'm not mistaken. Is there any other?
LastPass hasn't been completely free for a long time. They had it locked down to like one solution, one computer. You couldn't have it all over the place without paying for it. So
okay,
they did that a year or so at least before the last breaches last year.
KeePass is just a Rolodex on your desktop. That's useless.
There's Bitwarden. Several people in the chat are mentioning Bitwarden, which is my password manager of choice. If you want to pay for it, it's about $12 a year for the premium.
Okay, so it's the cheapest of the cloud-based password managers.
It is,
I think,
also
1Password is $35 or something.
Open source, like, notably, like 100% of Bitwarden's source code is open.
That just means it has supply chain attacks in it. That's scary. I don't like that.
Mm-hmm. That means the hackers can see it. They didn't even need to steal the code. They can just see it.
What about the built-in password manager on an iPhone? I recommend that to my friend.
Keychains? I think iCloud keychains are good. Mm-hmm. One question I have about Bitwarden, just since we're on the topic, does it have an SSH agent built into it? Because that's like the killer feature of 1Password that I love so much.
Does not.
No.
Well, looks like I'm not switching.
You could contribute that, Corey, because it's open source.
If I contribute it'll be written in Ruby and it will have many remote code execution opportunities.
And I'd heard that Bitwarden had some problems with iOS or macOS with it. I don't know if they fixed that yet or not.
I use it on macOS every day with much success. Are we talking about security problems?
No, compatibility issues is what I had heard, that there were some compatibility issues with either iOS or macOS.
I think when they first released the M1s, it didn't have M1 support right away, but did shortly thereafter.
Looks like the crowdsourced data that we have in our chat says that it's fine. So I guess, okay, so distilling this down, we're telling people to use iCloud Keychain if they have iOS devices. We're telling people to use LastPass still, even though they got breached. Like, I guess I feel like that's kind of that's to me like the barrier. It's like, would I tell family members not to use this company? And I feel like LastPass, I wouldn't be like, don't touch them. Like, it's still better than nothing. That's kind of how I feel
I agree. Jeff McJunkin made that point too. I still think it's better than using crappy 1Password for everything.
Or storing passwords in your browser.
In the browser.
It's better than any alternative. Like, if you get compromised in the LastPass breach, that's so much less likely than you either losing your spreadsheet with passwords, having a flood damage your Rolodex of passwords, or someone guessing your password, which is your name and your birth year.
Let's be honest, though, if your non-technical family member is still using LastPass, it's on inertia at this point.
Totally.
It's not because, you know, given the ability to go back in time and reset, you would recommend it ever again based on trust as a customer. because, you know, there's enough breach history here that this constitutes a pattern.
Can they ever, do you think they can ever reclaim, like, where they were? Like, do you think they can ever, like, win back the trust of the CTOs or CSOs across the board? And, like, I mean, or is this just kind of the beginning of the end for them?
They'll just rebrand it. It'll be next to LastPass.
It'll probably be time and someone else could get
penultimate pass. Should it be penultimate pass? All right. I'm going to go register that trademark. I'll be back.
That's a great segue to promote the webcast, is it not?
There's a webcast?
Yeah, there's a webcast. Was it next week or is it this week?
It's this week. I put it in the link in the chat, in the Discord chat, for our Thursday webcast, which is Cybersecurity Basics for Muggles and Minions with Ashley and Chris.
Nice. Yeah, so tell all your family members to go to that. It'll be fine. Let's end the show with some criminal justice. Has anyone, Derek, I guess, out of curiosity, have you ever run an incident with Reevil? Is it Reevil or Reevil?
I always said Reevil, but even though there's only the one E.
Reevil, that's how I'm reading it.
It does not ring a bell, so I'm going to go with
Or should I head. Should I make it regarding Ville? I don't know. Basically, the hacker has been sentenced to 13 years in order to pay $16 million. He's a Ukrainian national. His name was Yaroslav Vasinsky, a.k.a. Robotnik. Sounds like he was the evil guy. Was part of the ransomware group, orchestrated more than 2,500 ransomware attacks, demanding crypto in total of $700 million. Turns out he only had to pay $16 million, so I don't know if that... I'm assuming the demands were not equal to the payout. He was extradited to the U.S. following his arrest in Poland in 2021. He pleaded guilty to 11 counts of charging with conspiracy to commit fraud and related activity, damage to protected computers, all kinds of good stuff. So it looks like the only civil forfeiture that took place was 39 Bitcoins. How much is that worth? Not $17 million. And $6 million in U.S. funds that have been traced back to ransomware payments. So I guess there is an end of some ransomware groups. I guess I don't know if they caught the other people. Sounds like he pleaded guilty. So I'm assuming if he only got a 13-year sentence, he probably ratted some people out. Unless, I don't know what the standard is for ransomware these days, but seems kind of light.
I will say we're the same age and he has a lot more work history than I do with 2,500 ransomware attacks. That's like quite a bit.
Well, listen, they spiral up. The first one's the hardest, okay? Then after that, they get a lot easier.
Yeah, I mean, once you're at the top of the criminal empire, you're really coding anymore. I think you're just like a mid-level criminal manager at that point, right?
So an executive?
He
was a company ransomware founder and
chief ransomware officer.
Co-executive, right?
Disrupting the ransomware industry. He's actually giving a keynote at RSA in 13 years, some say.
Having dealt with, you know, these kinds of organized crime groups in the past, all I'll say is, hey, good for the DOJ and whatever international partners they worked with on this. But the reality is that, you know, nature abhors a vacuum and somebody's just going to flood right in and you know, occupy this niche in the criminal marketplace until it becomes a lot harder for these people to cash out and, you know, becomes a lot easier for law enforcement to catch these people. You're just going to see more of it.
And I'm pretty sure that that's what the internet's for now, right? To try and steal money from other people. I mean, it seems that way. Maybe I'm jaded because of all.
No. That's what banks are for.
Yeah. But I tell my kids that, you know, basically, especially now in the days of, you know, the video AI, and, you know, if you see it online, just assume it's false until you can prove it's true. So.
Totally. I've said it before and I'll say it again. You know, the ransomware people have figured out a way to monetize your technical debt, right? That's what they do.
So anyway, I'm going to create a new, IPO for just going to be an exchange traded fund of all the ransomware groups. It's going to be called. But no, I guess on the topic of ransomware, you mentioned filling the vacuum. It seems like Lockbit is going back and forth with law enforcement right now and trying to keep their stuff online. So recently, the Europol or whoever revived one of their seized sites to basically kind of tease, you know, hey, we're going to release some more data on this investigation. Even though, you know, we kind of followed the drama when it came out, but essentially they seized one of Lockbit's sites and then they just brought up another one. So basically it seems like law enforcement is trying to get the last laugh, but they're firing back. I guess this is kind of the hacker version of the Drake versus Kendrick Lamar beef.
That I was going to say.
So Lockbit is Drake and wait, which one is Lockbit Drake? I feel like Lockbit is Drake personally.
I mean, you know, piece of advice to the ransomware people, don't poke the bear, right? Like you piss off the DOJ and they have a lot of resources they could spend on making your life miserable. If you don't get greedy and you keep your crime below a certain threshold and you don't make a lot of noise, probably they're not even going to bother with you and you can make a nice living, right? But if you poke the bear, you know, they'll spend huge amounts of money just to get you, you know.
Totally. And Lockbit is the like ultimate one at poking the bear. They're the ones that had like a $2 million bug bounty for doxing any of their creators. So like pretty sure they're basically saying like, come and get us. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, who knows how it'll end up, but we'll stay tuned. I guess subscribe or whatever people do to this show so you can hear us talk about whatever the law enforcement people release on Lockbit. I'm sure we'll cover that when it gets reported. But yeah, I guess anyone else have any final articles or you know, fun little stories about their goats having diarrhea?
Can we just talk about for a minute systemd now coming with a sudo replacement, because apparently the attack surface of sudo is so large that it has to be replaced by the attack surface of an entire operating system. I like systemd when it first came out as a booter, but lately this shit has just gotten silly. I mean, so now it's a booter and it's a logging system and it's a task scheduling system, and now apparently it's a privilege escalation system. So let's talk about attack surface, shall we? Just like,
I just can't. Feel like sometimes Linux folks make changes, so I have to learn new stuff and my old things don't work anymore. So I'll just reinstall sudo, right?
Is that how I just want, say, I think there's like an underground community of people who are trying to sabotage Linux with this shit. I mean, like, you know, but mind you, like the same guy who created systemd is also the guy who gifted us with Pulse Audio.
Lord.
You know, yeah. You know,
I think my only question is this written in Rust? Because my only rule is that I only use things that are written in Rust now. So, yeah. So I guess I'd say I'm fine with it as long as it's written in Rust. Otherwise, I'm against it.
So what is the product?
Dog's leaving? He's so insulted. So
what is the product pitch? Like, I'm out for this new sudo systemd.
The product pitch is that it's somehow like less of an attack surface being folded into systemd than the original sudo, and because it's part of the operating system that's already in ring zero, like systemd can handle the privilege escalation and spawning the new process in a more secure fashion than sudo can. And maybe architecturally that's correct, but just from experience I can tell you that systemd has grown way too fast, way too quickly for me to believe that we're not just introducing a whole shelf load of new bugs by folding all this stuff into systemd. I mean, there's, you know, isolation, you know, exists for a reason, even between components. So
yeah, some people might even call that a toolbox philosophy.
Yeah. Somebody might say that. Yeah.
I guess I'm still not really clear. What was wrong with sudo? Like, what was the attack?
There's nothing wrong with sudo. That's my point.
I know. That's what I'm trying to sit here and think. Like, well, has there been a really big vulnerability? And
I mean, there's historically, there's been a lot of vulnerabilities.
Sure, but historically, there's been vulnerabilities for everything. Right.
Like, I mean, so, no, I don't. So, like, it, of all the squeaky wheels in Linux that needed grease, like, I don't think this was one of them, right? You know, it's just like, what are we doing here, guys? But then I felt that way about systemd timers as well. It was like, oh, you know, like, hey, what Linux really needs is another task scheduling system, right? Because like we've only got three at the moment. Let's add another one.
In Discord, I just published a new DOS vulnerability where all you have to do is alias sudo to run zero, and that'll just keep the admins out for months. So.
Is that going to make my Unix, Linux, and system administration handbook out of date? I literally bought it 2 days ago.
No.
No.
It's probably out of date.
No, because
it was out of date by the time you bought it.
No, we're still on kernel 2.6.
We got a cover on it.
Yeah, unless you're running the bleeding edge of stuff, you probably won't see it for a couple of years anyway, assuming that you're running LTS versions of things, right?
All right, let's go back to my original thing. Is that book written in Rust?
The whole book was written in Rust. That's right.
It's written in Rust with compiled with --unsafe.
Oh, no.
That is not factual, by the way. I have no idea what this is built in. But I always think it's funny that people say that Rust is totally safe unless you use --unsafe in the compiler.
Just like C, right? What could go wrong? Just don't mess up. Don't mess up your
memory.
Well,
we've already established that developers always, you know, write correct code, so.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the only possible response I can have to this that isn't just hell's completely correct is that there is some like undisclosed vulnerability that why wouldn't they just patch it or fix it? Like, I don't know.
We need a new system.
I can see if they're trying to limit the number of like set UID operations, because if we look at the paths to Prevesque over time, a lot of those come from misappropriating set UID. It doesn't come from sudo. It comes from plenty of other places in the operating system. But if you reduce
Do you not just set UID everything in bin? I do. Yeah. It's safer that way.
I just set UID my editor. It's really all I need. Mm-hmm.
Always set UID Vim, and then you know you can always edit sudoers if you need to. So it's fine. Yeah. Or I mean run zeroers.
Yeah. No, it'll be a systemd config file, right?
Those are super easy to write.
Yeah.
All right, I think it's time to call it. Thanks everyone for attending. Subscribe to something, click something, bells or something. I don't know. We'll see you all next week.